think that probably the way to do it is, what Cassie's about to say or has just said, which is, if you mute your mic, Tommy Solaris, if you mute your mic, there won't be the echo. So only turn your mic on if you need, if you want to speak. Okay, does that work?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm still hearing some echo. Okay, seems to work just fine. Matt is having audio issues. Okay, so let's see, how many people do we have now? All right, so we have 20. Okay, so turn your mic off. Until you want to speak. So at least on my version of the app, the mute mic thing is at the bottom left of the screen. Okay, testing. Okay, that works. So feel free, I'm just looking for my copy of Anthony Cleopatra. Feel free to turn the mic on whenever you want to say something, and feel free to say anything when you want to say it. So that's all good. The signal's likely garbage. Let's see. Yeah. Okay. What Tommy says. So everyone should also, I think, therefore be looking at chat, which you can, turn on in the right or just by clicking, you can turn on in the bottom and, it'll be on the sidebar on the right. Okay. This is a bit fitful for me. Raise hand button. Where is that? No, cool.
It is, you see the list of participants? It's right underneath that. It says mute me and then raise hand.
Okay, not in this version. So I see, okay, do other people see that? Oh, so is that bottom or top of the screen on your screen?
For me, it's in the middle and on the right.
The middle and on the right. Okay. I don't have that on mine, but maybe I don't get to raise my hand. So Nicole, could you turn your mic off and then raise your hand and I'll see what I get?
Yeah, okay.
Oh, okay. So Nicole raised hand. So if I click on you, do you... are you unmuted or?
No, then I would have to unmute myself, but it's just so that you could moderate when we talk if that's something you want to do.
Okay, why don't we try that? Or we could try people just unmuting when they have something to say, but if that turns out to be a little bit chaotic, then raise hands and I'll call on people based on who's raising their hand in the participant. And feel free to chat at any moment, obviously. So Matthew says, my audio cut out for a minute. What is happening right now? We just finished Act 5. I think everyone now understands what we need to know about Antony and Cleopatra. So it was quite a minute, Matthew. But we're set. So I guess that's the end of the semester. All right. So let's get down to it. So we were still in Act 1, Scene 1. And I think Antony and Cleopatra is... it's linguistically so amazing a play that it really is worth going through it if we possibly can, scene by scene, and just talking about the things that are going on in that scene. So what we've been looking at in Act 1, Scene 1 is we talked about the third person imperatives and also the way Shakespeare was setting the table. So just to... remind us of what we were talking about Tuesday. And the way Shakespeare is setting the table is partly by having Cleopatra talk about the fact that Antony is married to Fulvia. I'll seem the fool I am not, Antony will be himself. What you will see throughout the play, and it's something to think about when you're thinking about how you would stage it, is how much Cleopatra teases Antony and how much Antony actually likes the teasing. And it's not that he never, rarely, it depends on what his mood is, takes offense at the teasing because he understands it. And what you don't get in Antony and Cleopatra is the kind of amazing moments of people falling in love with each other that you would think you would get in a love story, that you get in Romeo and Juliet in the famous sonnet scene. Does everyone know? I don't know how I'm going to pull you on this, but does everyone? So I'll just remind you, allow me to remind you that when Romeo and Juliet first talk to each other, so someone is calling in. Does that mean I should click it? Oh, no, it's whoever's calling in is whose screen I'm on. That when Romeo and Juliet are talking to each other, they have an interchange which is itself a Shakespearean sonnet, and that's really lovely. When Troilus and Cressida meet each other, there's a moment, even though that's going to go bad, there's a moment of what you get in the comedies also. Anyone know where the line "whoever loved that loved not at first sight" is from? We talked about it earlier in the class, actually. So that is from As You Like It. It's a character in As You Like It is remembering Christopher Marlowe and says, "Dead poet, now I feel thy words of might. Whoever loved that loved not at first sight." That is, all love is love at first sight. And she is quoting, not Dead Poet, I'm sorry, Dead Shepherd. She is quoting Christopher Marlowe, who had written in Hero and Leander, when both deliberate, the feeling is slight, whoever loved that loved not at first sight. So love should always be love at first sight. We're going to see something like love at first sight, or you guys have seen something like love at first sight already, in the description of how Antony went to meet Cleopatra on the River Cydnus, and the famous description of Cleopatra, the barge she sat in on like a burnished throne burned on the waters, and Antony was stunned by the first time that he saw her. But there's no indication that she fell in love with him at first sight. And part of what Antony and Cleopatra is about is something that's different from the kind of love that most of the comedies and the tragedies both share. Othello and Desdemona, if they didn't fall in, well, she seems to have fallen in love with him at first sight. And if he doesn't fall in love with her at first sight, he falls in love very quickly. That kind of love shared by comedy and tragedy is the kind of love that can go well if you end with a comedy and people get married and live happily ever after, or can go bad in a tragedy because somehow the world won't accommodate the pure emotions of the lovers. And there you can think of Romeo and Juliet. Or it can go bad because of some misunderstanding between the two. And there you can think of Othello and Desdemona. Or it can go bad because the world is destroying what would otherwise be a pure love. And there you can think of Hamlet and Ophelia. But in Antony and Cleopatra, what you get is a love that has ups and downs. And that really is pretty rare, not only in Shakespeare, but in other representations of love. And so it isn't the kind of love in which you get, let's just say, for example, a dreamy symmetry. That is, both characters feel the same way about each other. Each feels the same way about the other as the other feels about the first. That would be a kind of dreamy symmetry. Nor is it the kind of love where when that symmetry is broken, it looks like things are going to be over. It is what you get in Antony and Cleopatra are people who have been around the block, who know a lot about the world, who know a lot about love, who don't have a pure idea of what love is, And for Shakespeare, that's going to turn out to be far and away his deepest love story, is the love story between Antony and Cleopatra. And then just to say one other thing about it, I was saying this last week, and I just want us to keep this in mind. But I can do it a little bit through something that I quoted from Dr. Johnson at the beginning of the semester, which is that Johnson, remember what he called a pun or a quibble? Anyone remember that? Raise hand if you do. Okay, so Johnson said that a quibble was for Shakespeare the fatal Cleopatra for which he threw away kingdoms and was content to lose them. So that is a comment really about Shakespeare's love of punning, which Johnson disapproved of. But it also tells you something about what he thought of Antony and Cleopatra, that Antony was over, as he himself is going to complain, but Johnson thinks this complaint is an accurate one, that he was obsessed with Cleopatra, unable to break away from her as he should have, and to go where his clear moral duty lay. And the idea is that his clear moral duty lies in Rome, in running the empire, in making sure that what goes on in the world isn't subordinated to his dotage, to quote Philo, over Cleopatra. So that opening speech, lots of people take that speech to be more or less right. That is, that this dotage of our general does overflow the measure, that he is selling himself, selling all his virtues off because he's in love, and he's in love with someone who is, and this is the other side of that claim, he's in love with someone who doesn't love him back, who's simply manipulative, who is looking for what suits her best rather than for what would be best for both of them as a couple, be best for her kingdom, which would be, let's say, to break up with Antony, that she should run Egypt and he should go back to Rome, that Cleopatra is the worst you could say about her in some sense is that she is parasitic. Certainly she's manipulative. And there's a whole lot of complaints you can make about Cleopatra. And one thing that's interesting is that they are all or mostly borne out by what she does in the play. And the real question is, so what? And that, for a lot of people, is a genuine question. The question is not, it could be rhetorical, so what? Or it could be, so how could this be real love? And that's her first question, if it be love indeed. You can take that as the question that lots of people have asked about the play. And the answer they've given is it's love on Antony's part, maybe, but dotage might be a better word for it. And it's certainly not love on Cleopatra's part. And that is, that's not my view in any way. So just to put that card on the table, that's not my view in any way. But it is the way Antony and Cleopatra was read for hundreds of years. I'm just trying to think when Antony and Cleopatra, when people cared enough about it to start discussing it. But Dr. Johnson obviously did. Later on, we'll read Dryden's rewrite of Antony and Cleopatra, All for Love. That's what we'll be doing the last week of the course. And so you can get another sense of what a really great poet who really loved Shakespeare was doing with his revision of Shakespeare just a few decades, or several decades, but 50 years or so after Shakespeare. So So Antony's reply to that is, but stirred by Cleopatra. So Antony will be himself, that is, he'll be the fool that he is. And Antony doesn't take offense, but he obviously understands what she's saying. But stirred by Cleopatra. Okay, so wait, I'm just... So Grace says, Helen of Troy is one of the apparitions in Faustus, I think. Tommy. We talked about raising hands. Is it Marlowe who talked about the face that launched 1,000 ships? Yes, that's correct. When Faustus sees Helen of Troy, he asks, was this the face that launched 1,000 ships and burned the topless towers of Ilium, that is, of Troy? So, yeah, it is Helen of Troy whose face did that. Do any of you, by the way, do any of you, if you don't, you should, but do any of you subscribe to the Paris Review poem of the day? You can raise hands. If you raise your hand, I won't assume you want to say something right now. So raise hands if any of you do. So I guess the answer is no. You should. And the Paris Review poem of the day today is, I'll try to remember to send it out on Latte later. No, I certainly can't hear you. Is your mic not muted, Tommy?
I don't know how to get it on.
Oh, wait. Wait, is that Tommy or Emily speaking? Okay. All right. So, to remind anyone whose mic isn't muted, you should mute your mic unless you raise your hand because you want to say something. And you can raise your hand by going to the participants part on your screen. Okay. So I'll try to remember to send you what is a really great poem that was the Paris Review poem of the day by the great Greek poet George Sepharis, who's one of the two or three great Greek poets of the 20th century. So I'll try to remember that. At any rate, so Antony will be himself is the joke that she makes. That is, he'll be the fool that he is. And his response to that is, but stirred by Cleopatra. That is, I may be by myself, but Cleopatra will arouse the stirrings in me to quote Jonas in The Giver. So now for the love of love and her soft hours, let's not confound the time with conference harsh. There's not a minute of our lives should stretch without some pleasure now. So what do you make of that line and a half? There's not a minute of our lives should stretch without some pleasure now. Someone paraphrase that. You guys, time to be talkative. I know you're on Zoom. How would you paraphrase that? There's not a minute of our lives should stretch without some pleasure now. Not that hard, is it? Is it too easy a question? Anyone? Let's see. I don't have this one. Okay, I can start calling on people. We could do it that way. And then we'll see who's like on Zoom but has muted their video camera and is off playing games in some other room. Okay, so the line is, it's Act 1, Scene 1, line 44 through 45. And Antony says... 46 through 47. And he says, let's not confound the time with conference harsh. That is, let's not mess up the time that, the present time by having a meeting with the messenger and hearing whatever harsh news he has to say. the messenger can just go off somewhere else. And then he explains why he doesn't want to confound the time with Conference Harsh. There's not a minute of our lives should stretch without some pleasure now. So, Ari, do you want to paraphrase that? Okay. Yeah.
Can people hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I'm not sure. Is this sort of his like hedonistic sort of mode of living in Egypt of like we shouldn't waste any time not doing anything that's not pleasurable?
Yeah. I guess the first question is, why now? There's not a minute of our life should stretch without some pleasure now. So someone wants to know what stretch means there. Does anyone want to say what they think stretch means? Okay, usually if time is, if you're like in a class and the class is going on and you can't believe a famous line that... I think it was Mark Twain said about Wagner's operas. Wagner's operas are notoriously long. They're like 6 or 7 hours long. And so everyone is really steeled for a long opera when they go to see a long opera. And Mark Twain said about it is, well, you go to a Wagner opera and you make sure you get there at 6 and you make sure not to start looking at your watch until at least an hour or so has passed, and then you look at your watch and it's 6:15. So if you're having that experience, that means that time is really stretching out, that you are not using your time in a way that makes it fly or that makes it pleasurable or that makes it something where you're lost in the... being totally present in what you're doing, you're just waiting for it to end. So there's a kind of oxymoron. Yeah, so he does mean that immediate pleasure makes time go by quicker, but there's a little bit of an oxymoron in the idea of a minute feeling like a long stretch of time. Some of you may remember Midsummer Night's Dream, what Philo Straits says about the tedious brief tragedy of Pyramus and Thisbe. Anyone remember that? I'm sure some of you do. Those of you who are in the Shakespeare class, yeah. So stress and frets is error upon the stage, but that's about how time is short. And that's very much true. Okay, Julia, I remember. So Julia, I call on you, speak. To quote King Lear, speak.
I just wanted to say I remember it. I don't have really that much to contribute that's worthwhile.
Okay, that is so not true. But okay, So what happens in A Midsummer Night's Dream is that they're after the wedding, but before going to bed, they're going to have a celebration, and the celebration is going to be lots of people have suggested various entertainments that they can offer Theseus and Hippolyta and the two other couples. And the entertainments that they offer, Theseus looks through the list of possible entertainments. And one of them is the set of entertainments that the mechanicals, that is that Bottom and Peter Quince and so on, have come up with. And it is called A Tedious Brief Tragedy of Pyramus and Thisbe. That's the title. And they're using the word tedious wrong. And they don't know it. It's part of the joke in the play that they don't know what the word tedious means. And the... Philostrate, who's a master of the revels, explains that after Theseus thinks that makes no sense, a tedious brief tragedy makes no sense. And Philostrate says, no, it makes perfect sense. I know a tragedy that's 10 words long but it's so bad that it is by 10 words too long. So the idea is that something could be 10 words long and still be tedious because the words were so bad. So the idea of a minute stretching is that the rhetoric there is we don't have a minute to lose. And why don't they have a minute to lose?
Could it have to do with like generations and age, and that they're like this like time of like that, like, you know, like she talks about like salad days and how that is like past, and now like at this point they want to spend like every minute like doing what they want rather than like what Rome is like telling Antony to do. So they're kind of like I guess ignoring these like other obligations that they have in order to like do this now.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Are people seeing me if I nod? Do you see me? Just say no in the comment if you don't. Okay, so lots of people are not seeing me. Do you have your screens on, and is it just not, is my camera not on? That's weird, because, yeah, video isn't on for us, so why is that? Huh. Okay, let me just see if I can, oh, start, that's stupid, there. Okay, now you can see me?
Yes.
Okay.
No, yes.
All right. God, didn't your life just get amazingly better? Just looking at those, no one's writing anything in the comments. Huh, I wonder what that means. Okay, so the idea then is, yeah, they're old. And one of the things, the dramatis personae that I sent you yesterday on Latte tells you their ages, but Shakespeare, as we talked about on Tuesday, isn't actually treating them as the age that they are at the start of the play. He's treating the scarce-bearded Caesar as about 23 throughout the whole play, even though 10 years pass, the fact that 10 years pass is simply not part of the play. So he's treating Caesar, Octavius, as being about 23. He's treating Octavia, his sister, as a younger sister, not an older sister. And he is treating Antony and Cleopatra as being the same, as being roughly the same age, although in reality, Antony is about 10 years older than she is. But he's treating them as being roughly the same age. And that age would be, let's say, early 40s. Late 40s, early 50s. And so a way you can think of it is that it's clearly a generational conflict between Caesar and Antony. That is let's spell that out immediately. It's a generational conflict between them. The generation that the women, that the two important women in the play, as politically important women in the play, their generations are therefore associated with Caesar's generation, Octavia associated with Caesar's generation, and therefore in her early 20s as well, and Cleopatra associated with Antony's generation, partly because she's associated with Julius Caesar, who is Octavian's adoptive father, his uncle and adoptive father. So you now have two generations of couples, again, a little bit like in A Midsummer Night's Dream, the generation of couples, which are the one generation is Antony and Cleopatra. The other couple is not an erotic couple, or if it is, that takes a little bit of interesting psychological reading, but that's the couple of, but the brother-sister couple of Octavia and Octavian. And you could do the psychological reading and argue that there's some something erotically troubling about the way Octavius is willing to use his sister as a cat's paw for Antony, use her as make her Antony's erotic partner as a way of bringing them together, but also making it the case that he then has a good cause to resent Antony, which is what he wants for the way Antony treats his sister. So, but the crucial thing is the difference in ages. And a way of thinking about this is to say that because Antony and Cleopatra are old, they do get old in the course of the play. That is, they start out as the older generation. And to the extent that you are keeping track of their ages, they're still the older generation and even older at the end of the play. Yeah. Or maybe a simple way of putting it is to say that Antony and Cleopatra are represented, the play covers 10 years of Roman history. Antony and Cleopatra are represented throughout the play as the age that they are at the end of those 10 years, whereas Octavian and Octavia are represented throughout the play as the age that he, Octavian, is at the beginning of those 10 years. So that's a way of talking about the extent to which Octavian represents the future, and so he represents the beginning of things from the beginning to the end of the play. He still represents the beginning of things, whereas Antony and Cleopatra from the beginning to the end of the play represent the end of things. So Tommy, Octavia is actually older than Octavius. At the start of the play, she is about 30, and Octavius is 23. I think that's in the Dramatis Personae that I sent out. But in the play, she feels younger than her brother. She is meek and obedient to him, and she's being depicted in a kind of standard way at the time of depicting younger sisters. Her conversation with her brother might remind someone of another conversation between a younger sister and her older brother in another Shakespearean tragedy. Anyone?
Hamlet.
Yeah, the way Ophelia talks to Laertes. Do we all agree that Laertes is older than Ophelia? Does anyone disagree that it's clear that Laertes is older than Ophelia? So we never find.
Maybe I thought Laertes was younger.
How come? That's interesting.
I don't know. Well, I was at theater camp one time and we did this really weird Shakespeare zombie play thing. I don't want to talk about it. It was horrible. But the kid who played Laertes, I guess, played him really young.
Uh-huh.
So I guess maybe that was it. I don't know. But I just always got the vibe that he was younger.
So I think it would be very, very interesting. In performances where he is younger are very interesting because it just shows then the person playing him has to play him as the know-it-all who thinks that the fact that he's male totally trumps the fact that he's younger when it comes to authority. And he becomes kind of it kind of makes him obnoxious, and which you may think he is anyhow, but he's even more obnoxious if he's telling his sister what her sexual life should be like. What's interesting about that is that you can then say that, well, but that's what Hamlet does with his mother. Hamlet is has ideas about his mother's sexuality and is instructing her on how she should manage her sexual life. And so if Laertes is a kind of double of Hamlet, then it's the same thing as well. Octavia is his actual, is yes indeed, Tommy, Octavia is actually Octavius' sister. So when Julius Caesar adopts Octavius, he's not adopting the whole family, but he's also not, Roman adoption is not like what we call adoption. You don't leave one family to enter another. It's partly a way of getting two families together. So the harsh, hang on. Are men always thinking the women's sexual lives is their business, though? Indeed. And the harsh conference, Tish wants us to get back to this play, is, yes, someone seems to be unmuted. The harsh conference would be with the messenger. So it could possibly also mean, let's not fight about this. But Antony doesn't seem to be worried about fighting with Cleopatra. It's rather, I don't want to confer. Conference, of course, is the noun for which the verb is confer. I don't want to confer with the messenger now, because there's not a minute of our life should stretch without some pleasure now. And what I think is amazing about that line is that if you were to paraphrase it, it means something like, there is so little time left to us because we are as old as we are that we can't afford to waste any of it, not wasting time. So the general idea is that you can either put your time to good use or to pleasure. You can either use your time for what, for your duty, or for pleasure. Duty versus pleasure is a standard opposition, and what you spend your time doing, anyone who is getting a paper in late because they've spent too much time partying knows that that the partying, which is all they do in Egypt, is putting pleasure above duty, and writing your paper and getting it in time is putting duty above pleasure. But what Antony is saying is, we should not waste any more time. We can't afford to waste even another minute. We should not waste even another minute not wasting time. So there's not a minute of our life should stretch without some pleasure now. Means we don't have much time left. And so we can't afford to spend any of that time in anything but wasting it on love, or doing at least what the Romans call wasting time. That, remember, is in Richard II. Richard, at the end of his life, and Richard is in some ways a good figure to compare and contrast with Antony. Richard, at the end of his life, summarizes what he's done wrong. Does anyone remember using the word waste? Great, great.
Oh, bowling broke. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead, Nicole.
Oh, bowling broke, how I wish I had not banished thee.
Well, he I don't think he actually says that, but it's when he's soliloquizing, and this is a genuine soliloquy. He's alone in Flint Castle, and I'm sorry, in Pomfret. And he begins by saying, I'm considering how I may compare this prison where I live unto the world, that speech. And then he hears a clock go off and he starts thinking about time and how he screwed up time. And what he then says, a great, great line is, I wasted time and now doth time waste me. So something anyone might think at some point in their lives. I wasted time, and now doth time waste me. But what Antony is saying is the way not to waste time is to spend all of our time doing what would be considered wasting time. That is, having sex and drinking and enjoying ourselves together and not doing what we're supposed to do. So a messenger comes from Rome. Philo has already said that Antony's dotage overflows the measure. Now here comes a messenger from Rome saying important news, and Antony won't hear it. And he says, there's no time to waste listening to the demands of duty. So there's not a minute of our lives should stretch without some pleasure now. What sport tonight? So the pleasure is sport. That's wasting time. Cleopatra, hear the ambassadors. And then Antony describes her and describes the way she teases Phi, wrangling queen, whom everything becomes. To chide, to laugh, to weep, whose every passion fully strives to make itself in thee fair and admired. No messenger but thine. And all alone tonight will wander through the streets and note the qualities of people. Come, my queen, last night you did desire it. And then, amazingly, to the messenger, speak not to us. And so, Antony, you'll remember from Plutarch that Antony and Cleopatra used to wander the streets incognito just to see what the people were like. So off they go. And now Demetrius and Philo end the scene. Is Caesar with Antonia's prize so slight? That is, does Antony not feel that Caesar is at all important? And then Philo says something which is actually very interesting. Sir, sometimes when he is not Antony, he comes too short of that great property which still should go with Antony. So how would you paraphrase that? Again, I don't think it's that hard a question, but it's worth paying attention to. How would you paraphrase that? Someone. So the line, again, it is Act 1, Scene 1, now line 57. As soon as Antony and Cleopatra exit, Demetrius and Philo, who were talking at the beginning of the play, Demetrius can't believe how Antony's just behaved. He seems to have borne out what Philo says at the very start. Is Caesar with Antonia's prize so slight? And Philo's answer is, sir, sometimes when he is not Antony, he comes too short of that great property which still should go with Antony. So I can start calling him people. Okay, Grace.
It kind of seems like he's suggesting that, like, when he acts like this and he, like, disregards, like, his duties in Rome, that, like, he's almost, like, not himself. So, like, when he's, like, in Egypt and, like, not, like, attending to, like, his duties, that he's somehow, like, not him, to kind of, like, shifts the blame off of him. Like, he's not consciously doing it. He's just, like, not himself.
Yeah. Okay, good. And Tommy says, on occasion, he acts unlike himself, and therefore he does not treat Caesar with the respect he, Caesar, deserves. Okay, so notice the formulations here. I think that's great, Grace. Notice the formulations here. Sometimes when he is not Antony, so that's, he's not being himself. As when we say to someone, you're not yourself, or someone says, I'm not myself today. But this would be an example of him not being Antony. And when he's not Antony, he comes too short of that great property which still should go with Antony. So that somehow there are two or maybe even three ideas of what the Antony is. Okay, that respect is the great property. At least in this context, but it's also whatever it is that Philo has described him as at the beginning, remember that opening speech, Those his goodly eyes that o'er the files and musters the war have glowed like plated Mars. Now bend, now turn the office and devotion of their view upon a tawny front, his captain's heart, which in the scuffles of great fights hath burst the buckles on his breast, reneges all temper and has become the bellows and the fan to cool a gypsy's lust. So to be Antony for Philo would be to be that figure, the warrior at the beginning of the play, whose buckles on his breast are broken by the power of his fighting, but now he's not being that way. So when he's not Antony, then he comes too short of that great property, which still would go with Antony. So that somehow being Antony is being described also as a property. That is, there is, which we talked about in this class in one context only, but it's the context that can maybe help make sense of this, which is the king's two bodies. So remember, there is the body natural and the body politic, and the small k king is the human being who is doing whatever it is that he does, and the human being who lives with bread like you, tastes grief, needs friends, feels want, tastes grief, needs friends. That's again Richard II when he's saying, why are you treating me like I'm a king? Subjected thus, how can you say to me that I am a king? I live with bread like you, feel want, taste grief, need friends. Subjected thus, how can you say to me I am a king? And that's the small k king. He is a small k king. The man versus the position, the Pope and the Holy See. Yeah, in Catholicism, it's when the Pope speaks ex cathedra, which popes almost never do, then they are speaking for God and not for themselves. Popes can make mistakes and they can apologize for mistakes, but if they speak ex cathedra, then they are infallible, according to Catholic doctrine, or according to older Catholic doctrine up through the 1960s. And infallible means that that's the capital P Pope who's speaking. So now it looks like there's a capital A Antony, and there's a small, not A, but H, he. So sir, sometimes when he is not Antony, that guy over there, when he is not Antony, he, that guy, comes too short of that great property, which is the capital A Antony. So hang on to those things, because those are going to be important later in the play. And one thing to see, it's already echoing something earlier in this very scene. Does anyone see or hear the echo? Here, I can't just call on someone at random because I'm not just asking for a paraphrase. But the question of being Antony. Anyone ever see the movie Being John Malkovich? No one's seen it? Yes, some of you have seen it. How could you not have seen it? Okay. Yes. All right. Of course, Ari. And so lots of people in Being John Malkovich get to be John Malkovich. And so those would all be small H or S people who for a while get to have the property of being John Malkovich in the movie. The movie, Elvie, is called Being John Malkovich. And it stars John Malkovich Oh, yeah, nice, Tommy. It stars John Malkovich, and various characters in the movie kind of get to go into his head and be him for a while. And one of the characters who gets to go into his head and be him for a while is John Malkovich himself. So even John Malkovich can be John Malkovich. And then you would say, so there's a small JM John Malkovich who sometimes is the big JM John Malkovich. And the same with Antony. There's a small A Antony who sometimes fails to be Antony. So who else earlier in the scene has talked about what it means to be Antony? Short scene, Nicole.
Cleopatra talks about what it means to be Antony, right? It means to be a fool, basically.
Right. So here are two definitions of what it means to be Antony. Yes, Cleopatra, there's stupidity. I'll seem the fool I am not. Antony will be himself. And we're nowhere, Matt. We're still in Act 1, Scene 1, now line 60 or so. So there are two ideas that the opening scene gives you, two extremes for what it would mean to be Antony. And one extreme is to be the triple pillar of the world. That is, to be one of the three equally powerful, most powerful people in the world. And Antony is failing to do that. The other is to be a fool. And that's Cleopatra's version of Antony. I'll seem the fool I am not. Antony will be himself. So those are two, those maybe show you the limits of what the idea of being Antony would be. On one extreme is a fool, and on the other extreme is the triple pillar of the world. And the small a Antony, obviously not really a small a, but the small a Antony is a figure who is somewhere, whatever property being Antony consists in, that property, the capital A Antony, is somewhere between fool and triple pillar of the world. So Demetrius, now speaking for Rome, says, I am full sorry that he approves the common liar who thus speaks of him at Rome. But I will hope of better deeds tomorrow, rest you happy. So the common liar means the gossiper, just everyone is has ideas. You know, they say nasty things about Trump because they just hate him. And they say nasty things about Antony because they just hate him. But in this case, Demetrius says, it's really unfortunate that he turns out that the kinds of things that everyone knows you shouldn't believe, just street gossip, turns out to be true. He proves that the common liar is right. But I will hope of better deeds tomorrow, so maybe he'll change. So just this is the he that approves the common liar is Antony. And what that means is, Tommy, is that he proves the common liar correct. Not approves as in says, I approve of what you're doing, but it's to approve in this case means to confirm. So he confirms what the common liar says, which means the common liar now is, whether accidentally or not, is telling the truth. And so anyhow, this is not a showy first scene, although Anne and Cleopatra are being showy. They come in and they're grand, and Antony binds the world on pain of punishment. To wheat we stand up peerless. But that's undercut immediately by the people who are framing the scene, Demetrius and Philo, who are complaining about the way Antony is behaving and the way both Antony and Cleopatra are behaving. So it's not a scene which is, whoa, look at these charismatic people, I'm overwhelmed. But it's nevertheless a scene in which Shakespeare, not very showily, sets up a whole bunch of things that are going to be really, really important later in the play. And that's kind of what I'm trying to underline for you. So in particular, the idea that Alexandria is the place not only of wastefulness, but of intentional wastefulness, a place where being wasteful, being spendthrift, being engaging in what you all know, the phrase conspicuous consumption, which is explicitly to consume in as wasteful a manner as possible. That is what Antony, again, explicitly says we have to do. We have to be as wasteful as possible. Time is running short. And we have to be as wasteful as possible. So yes, Tommy, this is my favorite of the Shakespearean plays. And something that I think will come out in my enthusiasm in various ways. And so that's one crucial thing to see here, is that Antony is declaring for wastefulness. Most people would say, no, I'm not wasting time. I'm doing something that's important. The reason I'm partying tonight is because I have to make connections which will help me on LinkedIn later in life. But Antony isn't saying any of that. He's saying, yes, I'm wasting time. Wasting time is the most important thing you can do. Do you guys still have the slang, get wasted? Is this all familiar to people? Okay, just checking out how young you are. How Octavius-like you are. So when people say they're going to get wasted, they sound like Antony. And that's what he wants to do. He wants time to be wasted. Then the other important thing to take from this scene is the question of the kind of King's Two Bodies version of being Antony. You won't be younger much longer. The King's Two Bodies version of being Antony, which is that there is this character in the play, and then there is this property that the character is either instantiating or failing to instantiate. Again, you can think of this a little bit as something that's true about drama in general, which is that you have actors playing roles, strutting and fretting their hour upon the stage. So that you could compare this, as people did, to small M Macbeth having to be Macbeth. That is, small M Macbeth is this frightened and guilty figure who has to nevertheless be the king and has to be king of Scotland. And in some sense, he fails. He is a terrible king. He is not the father of a line of kings. And in some sense, what you're getting in Macbeth, as in Richard II, is that the small k king fails to be this larger figure, the capital K king. And the small k king, I think this is also an important thing to say in general, not particularly for Antony and Cleopatra, but in general, is that the idea, and this is explicitly what Richard II is about, but the idea of seeing, of knowing what it's like to be a king, of seeing the experience of kingship from inside. Yes, Matt, that's great. The idea of seeing what it's like to be a king from inside is a suggestion that anyone watching this play, watching this movie, reading this biography, if you watch The Queen, for example, or Victoria on PBS, the idea is we can see what it's like to be such figures from inside. And from inside, we can imagine and understand what the human experience of being, of playing this role is. What the capital K king is someone who is godlike. That is God's vice-regent on earth, but that is someone whom we can't imagine from the inside. In the same way that we can't imagine what it's like to be God from the inside, because if we were trying to imagine what it's like to be God, one of the first questions we would ask ourselves is, how did I get to be God? How did that happen? And we don't think of God asking himself that question. And if we do, as some people in fact do, if we do think about God asking himself that question, what we're doing is we're thinking of him as being someone like us who God made God. And we don't see the capital letter, the uppercase figures from the inside. that's the crucial, or one crucial difference between small K and capital K. Possibly, but only possibly, a difference between small A Antony and capital A Antony. Yeah, just one second, Nicole. Are people clicking on the raise hand thing, or are you just, because I happen to see you, but I'm not seeing most people. So let me just say that we don't see it from the inside. And so in Macbeth, the idea of diamondization, the way Lionel Abel was talking about it, the idea of diamondization in Macbeth is that a figure goes from being someone we can see from the inside to someone, once they're daimonic, we can't see them from the inside. So just to answer Cassie's question and then Nicole, it diminishes his experience of kingship, possibly to some extent, yeah. It makes it less important for him because he's got a share. It's not the same thing as being king of England. But the great, and I think that's why Philo talks about the great property of being Antony. In a way, what it does for Shakespeare is it means that he doesn't have to talk about being king versus being an ordinary person. He has to talk about being a major person who is nevertheless negotiating with two other major persons versus being an ordinary person. But the major person, that's continuous between being an ordinary person and being a major person. There's a kind of continuity there. And so it's as though the idea of there being a property that you could be if you were Antony doesn't mean that there is this absolute gap between capital K king and small K king. There is a property that Antony, that would still be Antony if Antony were, did not come short of the property of being Antony. There's a property that would still be Antony, and he wouldn't have to feel the way Richard does feel, that it's entirely a role that he's playing and not himself. One way to talk about the greatness of Antony is that's Antony who would be that property. It's not that Antony would be some other property like the Pope or like the King. No, he would be Antony, but he would be capital A Antony. So I hope that makes sense. No one else in the world could ever be Antony. And sometimes Antony himself is not Antony. But many people could be king. The whole line of succession could be king. But only Antony can be Antony. So that would be the way to make the distinction. Nicole.
Yeah, is it possible that lowercase Antony is actually like a stronger person than uppercase Antony?
Well, it's... go ahead.
Because like I almost feel like lowercase Antony is someone who's completely unaffected by all of these people who are like kind of making fun of him. And he's completely... he knows what he wants. And he's someone who's like his sense of self-worth is not dependent on like how he's doing in war. He's not like Coriolanus kind of, so... I don't know if the lowercase Antony might actually be the kind of the better person to be.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Oh, are you reading something? So I think there is, it may be that the property of being Antony, I would like to reformulate that. I think that's the right question, but the way I would reformulate it is to say that it's not quite clear what the property of being Antony is. And the property of being Antony, according to Demetrius and Philo, is to be in Rome being a warrior. But the property of being Antony for Cleopatra, at least jokingly, teasingly, is to be a fool. Antony himself is going to have some views of what the property of being Antony is later on. And Cleopatra, at the end of the play, is going to talk about her dream of Antony. And one thing to be paying attention to in the play, maybe this is also a way, Nicole, of reformulating what you're saying, which I think is great, is look for places where people use the term, unusual term, an Antony, as though we would say a king, which we do say in Richard II, in front of Flint Castle, someone tells Henry that the battlements royally are the pennants of royalty are flying, and Henry's surprised, and he says, "Royalty? Why, it contains no king," and then Northumberland replies, "Why, no, my good lord, it doth contain a king. King Richard is in there." And that moment, which we didn't actually talk about in the Shakespeare class last semester, we talked about that scene, but not that moment. It doth contain a king is a way of making sure you get that K is lowercase. To say a king is different from saying the king. So when you use the indefinite article to talk about something, you're saying it's one of many. I have a class now isn't the same thing as having your only class now. So to say that it doth contain a king is to say they're one of many. Antony is sometimes called an Antony. And that is therefore implying that there is something which is being Antony, and any particular Antonys would be examples of that thing, but the thing they're examples of is larger than any individual. So they would be, philosophers call this a type token distinction. There's a type of thing, being king, being Antony, being a table, and then they're tokens or examples of those types of things. And so if it turns out, but notice that that's a little bit like the opposite of, that's the same idea, but going in the opposite direction, because what we're saying then is that that being an Antony is it's not the same thing as being the king. An Antony versus the king implies that maybe the lower level Alexandrian version of Antony is what the real quality or property of being Antony is. If you really want to be Antony, you have to be in Alexandria and not in Rome. So the conflict that everyone correctly recognizes in the play between Roman Antony and Alexandrian Antony, that conflict could be described as, if you really want to be Antony, you should be in Rome, says one side. If you want to be capital A Antony, go to Rome. And the other side says, no, if you really want to be Antony, you have to be small A Antony in Alexandria. And we talked earlier in this class about Cleopatra, when we were talking about how Shakespeare's text is sometimes wrongly corrected. And we were looking at the letter N and the letter U and how they can be misread. So Cleopatra says of Antony, as for his bounty, she says this at the end of the play after he's died, as for his bounty, there was no winter in it. And Antony 'twas that grew the more by reaping. And the editor and editors, the first editor, L.V., was Tybalt, but the editor and the editors who changed And Antony twas that grew the more by reaping too, and autumn twas that grew the more by reaping. As for his bounty, there was no winter in it, and autumn twas that grew the more by reaping. What the reason they did is because they didn't recognize that "an Antony" is a phrase that appears several times in the play. That they thought that makes no sense. You would say "an autumn," not "an Antony," but no, people do say "an Antony" in the course of the play. So that's a reason, again, to think of that property of being an Antony. Okay, we're not going to leave this week without getting to the beginning of scene two. So act one, scene two, enter Enobarbus. A soothsayer, Charmian, Iris, Mardian, the eunuch, and Alexis. So Alexis is a servant of Antony. He's male. The soothsayer is male. Mardian is male. Charmian and Iris are female. And there are no important figures yet in this scene, just as at the beginning of King Lear and in a pseudo way at the beginning of Act 1, Scene 1, we have conversation among secondary characters. And the conversation is Charmian talking to Alexis. "Lord Alexis, sweet Alexis, most anything Alexis, almost most absolute Alexis, where's the soothsayer that you praise so to the queen? Oh, that I knew this husband which you say must charge his horns with garlands." So what has Alexis told Charmian that the soothsayer has said? I am going to call on... save your classmate, or I'm going to call on someone right now, and it could be you. Okay. Emery. You're unmuted. I think you're unmuted. No, you're not. Emery, I'm calling on you. Unmute audio. There we go. Emery, what do you think the soothsayer has said to Alexis about Charmian?
Wait, what was the question?
Okay, so first speech in Act 1, Scene 2. "Where's the soothsayer that you praise so to the queen?" Then she says, "Oh, that I knew this husband, which you say must charge his horns with garlands."
But I didn't really print it out because it was going to be sent to his email tomorrow. That's the confirmation email that I got. Okay. I just thought it was...
Okay, it's hard. Are you finding it hard? Okay, Hannah, it is the first speech in Act 1, Scene 2.
Wait. Is this Act 1, Scene 2?
Yeah. The first speech in Act 1, Scene 2.
For the soothsayer?
Yeah, so Charmian is speaking to Alexis. Right? Do you have that?
Yeah, the first part.
Yeah, the very, very first speech. Can everyone see it?
Oh, yeah, I see it.
Okay.
How did you get there?
So, the very first speech. Oh, that I knew this husband, which you say must charge his horns with garlands.
Wait, where's... Okay. Wait, did you? What else is there? Oh, our stuff...
All right, too puzzling? Okay. Tommy, so are you puzzled by it?
Yeah.
Okay, so you can mute yourself again. Yeah, it starts with Lord Alexis. Tommy is asking whether the soothsayer is being used to find a husband for Charmian. Do I have to mute you, or can you mute? No, I think you muted yourself. Basically, Alexis has told Charmian that he's talked to the soothsayer, and the soothsayer has said that Charmian is going to marry a husband, is going to have a husband, who will charge his horns with garlands. So everyone knows that cuckolds, that horns means that you're a cuckold, right? Okay. I'm going to assume that you all know that the idea is that it's a constant joke in Shakespeare that people feel their foreheads to see if they are horns, because if you are a man and your wife is stepping out on you, then you grow cuckold's horns. Okay, so good news you can use. And what she's saying is, I wish I knew who my husband was going to be. Okay, that's a standard thing to want a soothsayer to tell you. But she's saying, this husband who will have to put garlands on his horns because he's going to have to enjoy the fact that I'm having sex with anyone that I want. So I'm really looking forward to figuring out who this husband is who I am going to be able to cheat on to my heart's delight. I'm really looking forward to that. So instead of saying, who am I going to marry? I really want to know. Will it be someone I love? Will I be happy? Will I be rich? The soothsayer doesn't say, que sera, sera. The soothsayer says, you'll marry someone who will be, he'll be happy, put garlands on his horns, even and the horns that he will have, because you will be able to have sex with anyone that you want. So it will all be great. Okay, so Charmian, you can see, is kind of, we can stop here and meet again Tuesday. I think we can go to the same meeting, but I'm not positive. I will try to figure that out. But I think you can just click on the same, to start the same meeting. We do, we'll go on, but just the final thing to say here then is that the first time we hear any of the minor characters in Alexandria, they are bearing out, confirming that Alexandria is the place not of morality or of duty, but of fun. So even when you're looking forward to the person you're going to marry, what you're looking forward to is a really wonderful husband, part of whose wonderfulness will be how completely pleasant all the polyamory you engage in will be for him. He's not going to mind at all. That's part of what's great about him. So again, this is the place that Romans would regard as dissolute, but that it's what Alexandria is like. Okay, you guys, email or text if there are issues that you had or anything else that you're worrying about in this way of doing it, or anything else that you want to talk about. But our plan will be Tuesday, same Zoom time and probably the same Zoom channel. So Tuesday at 12:30. Have a good weekend. Be careful and be safe and be healthy. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you. Bye-bye.